नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स। नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स। नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स। बुद्धं धम्मं संघं नमस्सामि। Lumpur asked me to give some reflections tonight on the Mantra. Maybe first off, just express my appreciation and great delight. Can I have the opportunity to come and visit the community here? As most of you know, I've been away from Abhayagiri for most of the last 4 years, and aside from just a few brief visits, coming down for the Upaska Day or Gattina, I've been up at the Pacific Hermitage, and having lived here for most of 12 years or something, it's a wonderful feeling to have the opportunity to come down and kind of be here for a little bit longer, a couple weeks or so, and spend time with the community, old friends, some of the lay people, neighbors, some of the newer members of the community. And I was really enjoying myself. The weather's delightful. And so it's interesting coming back to a community that you spent a significant bit of time in. Actually, Abhayagiri's the place I've lived longest in my adult life, 12 years. But you come back and you see things with fresh eyes, not just because Lumpur keeps building things and everyone keeps moving the furniture around, but it's just that sense of being away and coming back and in some sense, being a different person, being in a different place, in your own consciousness or in your own mind. And just been very heartened and inspired by just the sight of the monastery and the seemingly wonderful strengths of the community. And walking around this morning, talking with somebody that I've known for several years, who was just kind of passing through and talking about the community here, it sort of dawned on me. I said, you know, this is probably one of the biggest monasteries for Westerners to train and ordain in the whole world, and certainly by my standards, the finest. And when the thought kind of sprang to my mind, there was this kind of corresponding feeling of delight. just knowing what a rare and beautiful thing that is, and how difficult it is for the conditions to come together for something like this to exist. And with also that sense of how fragile it is, like anything in samsara. But I don't know, maybe even more so, something like this seems even more fragile in some sense. Ajahn Pasano, Lumpur Pasano, is such a solid character, it's probably easy to forget that when you're living here. It just seems maybe automatic or kind of a given. But that's not to be taken for granted. It's a special feature of his character, his barami, as they would say in Thailand. I remember really well the first time I arrived at Wat Nanachan, having just left for sabbatical or something. You have to kind of excuse me. I'm sort of in a place of reverie. And for some reason, there's all these kind of numbers and cycles in my mind that seem to be kind of converging tonight. So chanting the Padimokkha a little earlier, up in the mob or something, this kind of image popped into my mind. I have this very strong image of the first day that I arrived at Wat Nanachat, which is about 21, almost exactly 21 years ago now. It was May 1993, just before the Visakha Puja in May. So it kind of came to mind. And then all of a sudden I thought, I don't know why I thought this, but I thought, how old would Lumpur have been then? And so I thought, 44? I thought, oh my God, I'm older than Lumpur was the day I arrived at Wat Nanachat. So all of the younger members of the community, Mark, this event will happen to you in not too long. It doesn't seem that long ago. But I remember riding the Songtao out of Warin and getting off the villagers and the Thai people on this little rural Songtao, which is kind of like a converted truck that serves as a rural bus service. They're very helpful, kind of pointing off where to get off. I think I tried to get off several other places. I was so anxious to kind of find the monastery and so worried that this thing was going to pass the monastery by and I'd be left in some little village trying to find my way back. But they were very helpful and they said, get off here. And walked through the rice fields at that time. The whole area around Wat Nanachat was pretty much just simple rice paddies and rice fields and open. And you kind of walk through these rice fields and you get to the edge of this thick forest and come through the gates into the shade of this amazing tropical jungle. And it was morning time, Wan Pra, just like today. And there's this kind of broad concrete driveway that just stretched up sort of through the forest towards where the sala and the main area was. And there was a couple white-robed farangs, Caucasian men with shaved heads, sweeping this long driveway with big brooms. And it was pretty immaculately clean and tidy. And I remember just the coolness of walking into the shade and how clean and orderly everything looked. And somebody came up to me. It was an American guy by chance. And he kind of was very friendly and welcoming. He said, oh, welcome. Here, let me show you into the main area. The monks are off on Bindabat. But come set your bag down. And I learned later he was just kind of a guest staying in the monastery for a little while, but I had this kind of sense that kind of quickly sort of came over me of feeling like I'd arrived at a good place. And, you know, in a short time, the way I sort of remember it, and this comes back to me often through different points in my life, was there was this overwhelming sort of sense of this place, this monastery, is good enough. Yeah. And I'd been searching for a place to sort of practice for quite a while. And the thing that's so striking about that sort of sense is I sort of am of a temperament or a personality that is often perfectionistic and prone to sort of option paralysis, not easy to make decisions. And I look back now and I think it was kind of miraculous because I hadn't really visited that many monasteries. I probably could have shopped around for another few years or something, given my temperament. And been really picky, but I remember just kind of walking in and looking around, and something about the place struck me. And true, I was hungry to find a place to practice, but there was this kind of just immediate sort of sense of this is good enough. It's time to settle down and really dig in and get to the practice. And, you know, only years later would I kind of come to realize sort of how good it was. But I count myself as incredibly fortunate that I had that sense, because, you know, over the years I've met many people that never came to that sort of sense, or spent a long time, many years. I remember met one guy, 20 years he bopped around monasteries looking for places to ordain, and everything wasn't quite good enough. And I don't think he ever ordained, not that I know, who knows. But I remember just being struck by that sense. And this man, I remember he told me, "Oh, you know, just put your bags over there. You know, it's one pra, it's a special day. The monks are on alms round. They'll come back soon. And then it's kind of a little sort of open time before the meal. So they're, you know, most of the monks are doing chores or this or that or whatnot. So you probably won't be able to speak to Ajahn Pasno, as they called him in those days, until after the meal." And being nervous and anxious, that wasn't real satisfactory. I wanted to meet him right away and get confirmation that I could stay. Or I think I was worried that they hadn't got my postcard saying that I was coming up the monastery. And I remember seeing a couple monks kind of walking here or there, going to the bathroom or going off to their kuti for something. And this man sort of said, "Well, I think I saw Ajahn Pasno over in the hall." So I thought, well, maybe I'll go over and see if he's free. And I walked over to the meditation hall, and there's like one or two monks sitting meditation before the meal. And Lumpur was sitting at the head of the line at his seat, meditating. And I remember what a kind of confirmation of that earlier sense of, you know, this place is good enough, that was, you know, sort of just seeing the abbot of the monastery sitting meditation, you know, after being told that, oh, this is an unstructured time kind of before the meal. And I remember just how kind of heartening it was, and even inspiring. It's like, oh, the abbot, he must have a lot of duties, and there's this tiny little gap before the meal, and what does he do? He sits down and meditates. And I found that really helpful. And it helped solidify that kind of feeling, and I stayed. I stayed and I ordained. And I don't know, 21 years later, visiting this monastery, I can't help but have this kind of same sort of sense that something of that quality is alive in a very different place and a very different time. And all of you are enjoying the benefits of that and partaking of that. So over the past 4 years, I've been kind of up in the Northwest, and having just sort of left to begin a year of sabbatical, I'm kind of in this wonderful space of feeling free and light. It's always nice to be a guest. One of the themes that I've been sort of contemplating, sort of preparing myself for upcoming kind of period of retreat is just arousing this sense of kind of lightness and kind of using it to sort of brighten the mind, arouse energy. And in some sense, one of the contemplations that keeps coming up to me over the last couple of years is although Buddha Dhamma is kind of varied and diverse in so many ways, another way when I kind of look at it and I contemplate it, it seems to be all one. It's like a fractal, or if we can maybe borrow Ajahn Buddhadhamma's kaleidoscope. instead of three mirrors, maybe there's a magical LED in the middle of the kaleidoscope, and all these kind of mirrors, as you turn the kaleidoscope around, refract all the different various kind of sets of dhammas and elements to the dhamma, and then the different practices and the values and the virtues that the Buddha expounded upon. But in some way, having practiced for a number of years, I often come around to this sort of sense that it's all one. It's all one Dhamma. It's all, in some sense, simple and integrated. What seems maybe at the outset as this vast array of teachings, and maybe even at times kind of overwhelming, sort of like, wow, there's so much to there's so much to learn, develop, to practice, and that can feel overwhelming when it seems sort of divergent, but as we live it, as we practice it, as we study it, as we contemplate it, it seems to be more and more. It's like how it all integrates into one, and it's not just overlapping, it's kind of one Dhamma. And you know, the Buddha, when pressed to sum up the sort of the purpose of the teaching, is it's just suffering and the ending of suffering, and each and every aspect of the practice kind of somehow fits inside of that. So, you know, even when I think of like lightness, or think of, you know, sort of, I always have this kind of strategy for my practice in different time frames, like for the day or for the week or something. And it's usually something that just kind of spontaneously presents itself to me and inspires me. And so, like, you know, this concept of lightness comes to mind. And I think, well, how does that, you know, how can I relate that to sort of something that is beyond just kind of feeling happy or giddy or free from responsibilities or something? Like, how does that relate to this kind of one Dhamma? And you just sort of think, I mean, when I'm often talking with people about dukkha, one of my favorite ways to translate that or talk about that is heaviness. That which is dukkha is heavy, is inherently sort of heavy. It burdens the mind, it sullies the mind, it weighs the mind down, it robs us of light, it robs us of energy. That is dukkha. Sort of as I move kind of through my day, and I kind of watch over my mind, that's as something like, I guess I try to pay attention to. I remember when I first started practicing and studying the Dhamma, it was more like I was trying to apply myself to this sort of set of teachings, and I remember many times sort of sitting there sort of, okay, I'm mindful, I'm aware, I'm watching over my mind, and then all of a sudden this thought would kind of pop in, But am I suffering? Is there dukkha? And doubt and confusion would just usually kind of overwhelm my mind. And I just sort of, my mind would start sort of spinning around. It's like, I don't know. I don't know if I'm suffering. How do I know if I'm suffering? And the only thing I, you know, the only way I could start to try to sort of work my way out of it was like thinking back to the books and thinking, well, okay, let's see. What did it say in the book? Is there greed? Maybe, well, no, I don't know. I can't see greed. Is there hatred? I'm just sitting meditation here. I don't hate anything. I must be delusion then, because this certainly isn't Nibbana. But, you know, over time, you know, so we learn to kind of become our own translators, and we learn not just to find kind of various words that we resonate with as we pick up the practice and study it and put it into practice. But even, I think you develop kind of a sense for it even. And one of the senses that I've kind of developed in connection with suffering is just the sense of, you can feel it, you can intuit it. It's quicker, it's, you know, the mind can be quicker than this kind of verbal exercise that I was trying to engage in. It's like, you can feel if the mind is spacious or free, or if it's burdened. You can and you can feel if the mind is heavy or light, and to what degree it is. And this kind of lightness kind of corresponds with that which is kusala, that which is wholesome, but also that which is free, or at least to some degree free from what we might say is the kind of coarser expressions of dukkha. And if you think about the various aspects of the path, think about what is kusala, or what are the characteristics of generosity and giving and selflessness. It's light. It's light in a social dimension, like it's a light way to sort of relate to others, but also it brings that feeling of ease and lightness and brightness into your own heart and mind when you act in a way that is generous, giving, selfless. We contemplate virtue and morality, that which accords with the path, that which accords with the Buddha Dhamma, that which has any feeling of heaviness. It's probably related to something that is unvirtuous, or at least unskillful, or maybe even kind of inappropriate or inappropriate. It causes heat, causes friction, it causes a sense of heaviness. It leaves a stain or even a kind of a burden in the mind. Maybe it doesn't feel heavy when you're in the midst of it, or you're not mindful of it, or you don't notice it, but if you think about it over the span of time, it leaves a dent. You know, later it comes back to you again and again. You feel some sense of remorse, or you feel some sense of worry. It weighs on the mind. It kind of drags you down. Keeps you from staying in a place which maybe is brighter, more open, lighter, more flexible, free. And, you know, on and on. And the practices of renunciation, the practices of mental cultivation, especially the practice of of meditation, you know, when the hindrances are abandoned, the body even feels light, buoyant. The mind feels bright. The heart feels warm, buoyant, a sense of ease. And I don't know, it's interesting how you can just pick up some sort of theme like that and spend the day or spend an hour or spend a week or spend a month even kind of mapping that to all the various kind of forms and aspects of the Dhamma. And it can be kind of like a point of practice or a point of mindfulness as you move through your various duties and responsibilities, chores. One of the other things that I've been sort of working with and contemplating over the last couple of years, it's interesting. I used to listen to a lot of Dhamma talks, and I'd say most of the time I've been up living at the Hermitage, I've listened to very few Dhamma talks. And part of it, I've kind of had this sense that I gotta find my own vocabulary. Or it's back to this sense that I have is we have to be our own translators in a way. Or I don't know, another way I talk about it is I've gotta make this real for me. And I don't know, it was really strange. I just had this sort of sense of like, I can't listen to that. I have to I have to put that aside for a little while and really do this kind of difficult work in some sense of like finding my own voice or finding out what I really know or how much I can do with what's there. And kind of along the same lines of this contemplation of sort of like the interrelatedness of all dhammas or something. One thing that's kind of interested me is kind of like how much you can do with just a little bit, in a sense. And I remember thinking about what it must have been like to sort of live at the time of the Buddha. I mean, in this day and age, we kind of take it for granted. There's all these Dhamma talks, there's all these Dhamma books. We have the Tripitaka printed in all kinds of languages, and we can study it backwards and forwards and memorize all the kind of wonderful aspects to it. But I was thinking, you know, like, what must have been like to live in the time of the Buddha? And although the Buddha's alive and there's all these kind of great disciples, they certainly didn't have all that. Okay? I'm certain that they didn't walk around sort of with 500 Dhamma talks in their pocket that they could just sit and listen to over and over at any time. And I was kind of struck by this kind of concept of, you know, how much can you do with just a little bit? And one of my favorite collections has always been the Sutta Nipata. And I was told many years ago that that's considered one of the older kind of strata of the Tipitaka. Don't know if it's true or not, but I like to think that's true. And so I started kind of rereading some of the suttas in there. And one thing I was kind of struck by with a few of the suttas in there was how they seemed to sort of fit this idea I had of being kind of a complete teaching in a way. And one of the most well-known suttas in there is the Metta Sutta. And in some sense, I think this kind of typifies that sort of sense. It's like, and a couple winter retreats ago, I spent several months kind of going back through the Metta Sutta I kept looking at the Pali and looking at several different papers and several different people's translations of the various kind of Pali terms and kind of going through it. And what inspired me was how in some sense this could be a very kind of complete teaching. It's like the front bit of the Metta Sutta has these 15 qualities that the ideal practitioner of metta sort of develops. And then the sort of what I consider the second half of the sutta is then all about the sort of cultivation of metta bhavana, loving kindness. And so you kind of have like Dhamma Vinaya in a sense, like, or Vinaya Dhamma. You know, you have these kind of 15 qualities, and in many ways they encompass so many kind of values and virtues to be cultivated. And then you have the practice of metta bhavana. And so for the last couple of years, that's been something that I've made a regular kind of practice of, and usually in the morning time when I'm meditating, I start off just by kind of going through those various kind of qualities, those various 15 qualities, and I've kind of come up with short sort of one-word translations, which I feel are kind of meaningful for me, but also they're kind of short, so they work well to sort of reflect on. And I can just kind of go down sort of through the list and sort of review these kind of various qualities and reflect on them in various ways, both kind of inspiring the mind, but also kind of contemplating the sort of values of those qualities and how they relate to the cultivation of Dhamma. And then, you know, sometimes one particular quality sort of like stands out in the mind. So kind of being where I'm at right now, having left on sabbatical, one quality that stands out is quality of having few duties. Apakicho in Pali. And you know, in some sense, I think the deeper, you know, the sort of direct meaning of that is not being, literally not being overburdened with responsibilities. You know, but in some sense, it's maybe how you also kind of relate to duties and responsibilities. But just kind of like the last several days, or actually last couple of weeks, because before visiting here, I was also at Birkin Monastery and just kind of contemplating sort of having this kind of space where I don't have to sort of talk Dhamma every day and sort of teach sort of weekly duties and attend to the various duties and responsibilities that I have at the Hermitage. It's interesting to contemplate sort of like having fewer duties than what that kind of does to the mind, like how that sort of changes the character of your mind and your thought and your moods, and how that further kind of supports this kind of lightness of heart and ease of mind. And normally I spend some time just kind of going through that list, and if something stands out, maybe contemplating that sort of for a period of time, and then at some point kind of like moving on to just practicing sort of metta bhavana, but always trying to sort of honor those kind of two sides of the practice, and in some sense, like, even just, you know, sort of regularly and daily sort of like reflecting on those various kind of qualities of being or virtues or values, however you like to sort of label them, And seeing those as integral to also the practice and laying the kind of foundation for being able to really arouse a genuine sense of goodwill and loving kindness for myself as well as for others. And how that kind of relates back to those various kind of qualities, being able, upright, straightforward, gentle in speech, as they translate it, or receptive, as I like to say. And how, as part of that sort of well-wishing and that sort of sense of goodwill, you're not just wishing for this kind of feeling of heart, but also wishing yourself further growth and development in all those qualities. So for this one part night, there's just a few kind of reflections for everyone to take on and consider. Hopefully you find something useful in that. We'll leave it there for tonight. Pandamayan Dhammakataya Sadhu Karandana Se Sadhu.